Warren Buffett always recommends to buy companies with great moats. A moat is something that makes the company unique and protects the business from the competition. Patents are the best moats ever. Do you want to know why? Then listen to Gerda Dedel.
If you want to develop a product, we will find a way to patent it. Yeah, And it's not so much of the question of whether you get a patent, if there was a prior one, because there's always a way of further developing an invention so that it's even better. Yeah, so it, in a way, it triggers improvements if there are already patents out there. But the question is whether you're dependent on it, whether you have the freedom to operate if there was a patent out there.
Dr. Gerda Dedel is a patent attorney with more than 20 years' experience in the life science industry. Her technical expertise in the fields of biotechnology, biochemistry, and chemistry, including protein engineering, biologicals and small molecules, biomarkers, antibodies, alternative scaffolds, and libraries. Prior to founding Redel Life Science Patent Attorneys, she held senior positions in biotech, mid-sized pharma, and big pharma companies. She graduated as a biochemist and received her PhD in microbiology from the Technical University of Vienna. In this episode, we are talking about the value of patents, fast-track protection, key territories in a globalized world, digitalization, and interdisciplinary inventions. I hope you enjoyed the show the same way as I did. Welcome to a new episode of the Life Science Get Together Beginner's Mind podcast. Today with a special topic about patents. Warren Buffett, famous investor from the United States, always speaks about how important it is for businesses to have a moat that distinguishes the company from other companies. And ideally, it's a great economic moat. And in my opinion, one of the best moats that a company can have are patents. And why that is a great idea for any company to file patents and how that helps is today's topic. And I'm very happy to have in this podcast recording, one of Austria's best patent attorneys, Gerda Dedel. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Christian, for the invite. Happy to be here.
It's good to see you again. How have the last 2 years been for your office?
It was a great boom time. As you can imagine, the interest in life science patents has grown heavily, and great ideas, great investments, great business opportunities in the field, not just COVID-19 related, but the whole field has developed very much, and I'm really proud to support this on the sides of the patent.
Yeah, the interest in life science grew tremendously since March 2020. I was always surprised how quick everybody learned about the essential, moving parts in the pharmaceutical industry, what clinical trials are, what research can do, what diagnostics is, medical devices, drug development. But sometimes I felt that patents are not really understood so far. One of my first questions to you is, I mean, patent in essence is basically, I would say, I mean, in past it was a piece of paper. And now when I look at data rooms, I see a bunch of PDF files. Can you explain for the novice what are patents all about? Why is that such a powerful instrument?
Patents are assets. Yeah. And when, you know, our tagline is when it comes to patents, we mean business. So it's not just a piece of paper that you put on the wall. It's something that which is the basis for developing a business. As an asset, it gives you a right to exclude others, a right to have a competitive advantage over the over others who want to produce copycats. So you can actually prevent that somebody does the same without your permission. And your field, that is your scope of the patent, that is in a patent claim. And it's all about a patent claim that is granted by an office nationally, internationally, and then you can make a business out of it. It's like a basement. If you think you are generating a basement and then you're building a house, so you're building the business on the solid basement, and then you can rent the apartment or sell the apartment. So you can develop this business. Maybe this helps you to have a picture in mind.
Absolutely. When you think about patents and what you said, the part that resonated the most with me was that it's an asset that basically protects a certain part of an industry or helps to avoid that others enter this field. It basically creates a virtual monopoly for a couple of years. One question I have, I mean, you heard about many different kinds of patents, so your composition of matter, process patents, use patents. Are all patents created equally, or are there any significant differences? Which patents are of value?
Maybe some general thoughts about the value. I think what I learned so far is the value is determined by many factors. Like a key factor is competition. If there are several parties that are interested in this subject, the price will go up. Yeah. If you're the only one in the world, you don't need a patent. Because if nobody has an interest in copying this, then it's not worth a patent. But if there are several parties who want a business opportunity or want a license or sell it or maybe copying it, the price is going up. If the scope of protection allows alternatives, because you have a very slim claim, a very small patent, and everyone can work around it, the price will go down. Yeah. So if your patent is dependent on another one, so there is no freedom to operate without a license, the price will go down. So the value is determined by the market and the business opportunities in essence. Yeah. So in insolvency cases, the price is going down because if nobody wants this asset to buy this asset, again, the market is not good for it. So we can then discuss which patents are of value. Those that serve your business, I think, is the best answer. Because if you have product claims, they are usually very strong because product claims have a scope to protect all products the producing the product or using the product. As soon as you have the product in your hands, you are possible infringer, and you would need a license. With use claims, it's sometimes not so easy to police, but I would not underestimate use claims. So what medical use claims in life science, we always talk about medical use claims or diagnostic use, because at the end of the life cycle of patents protecting a commercial product. Yeah. In most cases, there are use claims like the clinical use, those treatment regimens, and so far. And because first you have broad basic patents, then you have some more specific patents on formulation, but then maybe on the use, maybe in the life cycle of your product, they are the last patents with the longest patent term. And at the end of the patent term, every day counts. So at the end of the patent term, the most valuable claims are the use claims in most cases. Yeah. So I would not underestimate or generally say use claims are less of less value than product claims. So maybe one other category is platform and product. And I experienced that because we're talking about the future. I experienced that there is a trend nowadays to more and more early stage business assets and business opportunities. So when I am supporting investment cases and due diligence, I realized that, let's say, a few years ago, people were looking for late stage products, those that are clinical development or at least IND stage. But nowadays, it's more and more early stage investment cases. And this means platform technologies, not only fully developed products. Yeah. And as long as they are innovative and there is a market potential. So what would you think is of higher value when you think of the mRNA vaccines? Is it the technology of stabilizing mRNA or the vaccine product with a specific RNA encoding the spike protein of SARS-CoV-2? What would you think? Platform or a product?
When I come from my personal investment preferences, I would go for the platform technology, which can be the basis for many products. A single product, I mean, mRNA, now it's very popular, the vaccines. But the discussion around it I see on the media is that probably new variants need change in the products. So when I just imagine that one patent is just for one product, let's say for one variant, and in a couple of months we have the next variant, and mm-hmm. the specific patent is only linked to one variant, then why should anybody buy that if the current vaccine or the old vaccine is not helpful for the new variant? So Moderna or just in my mind, just waking up, Moderna or BioNTech need to then produce a new product and file for a new product patent. But when they have a strong patent around the technology, I believe everybody who wants to produce a product needs at the end of the day a license from the initial technology. The question I have to you is, have I the right understanding of this patent world, or did I miss something in my explanation that I lacked some information?
Yes, definitely. I would agree. At the time the platform technology was developed for these mRNA vaccines, that was already starting in 2005. Mm-hmm. So that was early stage. So when it was valued at that time, it was okay, was seen as having a high risk a low attrition rate. So which means that the value at that time was pretty low. But nowadays, of course, it's good to have a platform. As you said, there could be a series of different vaccines produced with the same platform. And I mean platform technologies like mRNA stabilization or formulation in lipids and nanoparticles and so forth. So I think it's always about a portfolio. So you would need to have the right mix of a platform technology and then product-directed claim. Yeah. That would be the best, because then you could have a business of developing different kinds of product with different business partners based on one platform technology. So this is about the subject that are under discussion and where you can play with and find the right strategy, not only with your business, but then also with your patent portfolio. So it's about developing the patent portfolio.
BioNTech probably is a good example because it's related. Everybody knows these days, yeah. BioNTech and Moderna. It was different in 2019, as you said. I mean, mRNA vaccines in 2019, mostly nobody had an interest in it except the hardcore life science investors. Just imagine, I mean, initially you said that if nobody wants to copy your technology, you don't need a patent at all. Is that really a wise approach? I mean, just thinking about BioNTech, before 2020, mRNA had potential, but not many companies were doing something with that. I just imagine what if the inventors of the mRNA technology have decided a couple of years ago, we don't need a patent because nobody seems to be interested. And now in 2020, suddenly something occurs internationally that changes the view on this technology tremendously. What would be your advice when you hear from a scientist, yeah, my technology is good, but nobody is interested, so I don't have the money for filing for patents?
There are famous examples for this. For instance, the famous MRC in Cambridge, famous for developing recombinant antibodies. At that time, there was a Nobel Prize winner, but the people of the tech transfer office, they said, oh, nobody will have an interest. So if of course it's about inventions and new markets, and as you know, marketing experts, they always have a hindsight interpretation of the market and hardly can expect which will be the market within the next 20 years. They have a hard time evaluating inventions. So, I mean, you would always need to have in mind that the patent term is 20 years and the market can develop.
Sorry to interrupt you, but 20 years in business is a very, very long time.
Yeah.
So a lot can happen in 20 years.
Yeah. And the mRNA technology was at first developed in the direction of oncology vaccines. So for many years, people were trying to develop oncology vaccines based on this platform technology. And this was a good starting point for the infectious disease vaccines, because they didn't need to start from scratch. And there was already a development process ongoing. So it's especially for universities or the MRC institution. At that time, it was very, very hard to estimate which will be the value of this invention. But having this is a kind of creative process, of course. You need to imagine what can you do with such a technology in the future. And I mean, at first you need to be brave and very optimistic and think it can be used in many different areas. And later on, when patenting gets more costly in the national phase, so 3-5 years after the first filing, then it gets costly. Then you can think of restricting territories if you're not so much convinced of the value and if you do not want to invest more money. So you can then abandon country by country or abandon the whole family if it turns out that there is really no interest in this technology.
I mean, I would give it a business turn. Just imagine an inventor. So when an inventor says he will never, ever do something with the invention that helps bringing his invention or her invention to potential customers or, in our case, patients, then I think it can be questioned whether a patent process makes sense or not if there is a clear no towards commercialization or turning it into a product, if it's just the publication that's important.
This is what I would say to a client. If nobody, it's a nice invention, but if you do not want to do anything with it and you do not want to let others do anything with it, I mean, it's just a piece of paper on the wall and this is of no use and just costly. You'd better take the money and have a nice vacation.
But the minute when someone says, no, of course, I want to see it in a product, it should help people. I think patents are key to success, because if this person then wants to maximize the potential of licensing partners, he or she needs to have patents, because without patents, I cannot imagine any pharma company stepping into putting billions in development and commercialization when they cannot redeem their expenses. Yeah.
If there is not yet a patent, they will immediately try to get one. They will, if they only sell, buy know-how, it's very much dependent on was there really confidentiality regarding this know-how, and is there a leakage in this kind of trade secret system? And also the value of just know-how license is pretty low compared to patent license. Yeah, so
This is an interesting point that I would like to discuss a little bit further. I mean, there is always this around patents, it's this mystery of being a secret. So before filing a patent, nobody should be aware of the invention, ideally. When I come from the deal structuring side, I mean, it's like a market. We need to be out in the world and tell everybody about the great invention to attract potential licensing partners and investors. I mean, ideally, there is a patent process before anybody goes out on the market. But in the real world, very often, these two parts are interlinked. How dangerous is it really for the patent process when somebody like me, for example, runs around on the market and tells the people, hey, we have a new invention, we can produce a product with that. Do you want to see it? Does it harm the patent process in case no patent has been filed yet?
Of course, this is a major issue, because if you tell somebody without confidentiality agreement, it's published. So it doesn't need to be a publication in a scientific paper to get an invention anticipated. There will not be a patentable invention anymore if you have freely discussed it in the public. Then it's no more novel, and the patentability is destroyed. So. Better file first and then go around and talk about it.
Better file first before being sorry. Did I get it right? The confidentiality agreement can fix that problem? Is it really?
Yeah. Of course, it needs to, the parties need to respect the confidentiality, not just have the confidentiality agreed on the paper and then be in breach of this agreement. But if you trust in the other party that they are taking care of confidentiality, this is the usual way of proceeding, because as soon as you have filed the patent, you want to market it. Mm. Yeah. So big institutions or big pharma, they usually try to keep that longer on the confidential level. But if you are dependent on marketing your invention, because you need an investor, you need a business partner, then you go out to conferences. Then you have a non-confidential teaser, and later on, under confidentiality, you can have the confidential information package for a review.
Ideal world would be to have the patent process started already and filed for the first patent before going out on the market. So it's
of course, yeah.
Uh-huh. I mean, this relates all back to which patents are of value, in my opinion. Because, I mean, as you said, when people run around on the market and then start filing for patents, then the value is gone, of course, yeah. So better be careful and ask an expert beforehand. The patent then is the foundation of creating a business. And we have heard now that there are several types of patents. In your opinion, what is really the strongest approach that a company can go when they start their first business?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
As a business start, you have a business idea in mind, and some commercial products, be it really composition of matter or services. Yeah. So these are commercial applications which can be the subject of patent claims. And you better discuss with a patent attorney. So how to build a portfolio of patent protection that is helpful. So as we discussed beforehand, you can maybe have a platform technology and then some specific composition of matter that you want to develop. You might think of technology like screening a lead candidate, then the lead candidate itself, method of producing the lead candidate, and formulation and some assay systems to find out whether the lead candidate is really a good one. So these are the aspects which could help to build a patent portfolio that is supporting your business idea. So it needs to match your business purpose. That's why we always say when it comes to patents, we mean business. it's case by case. And that's why it needs a discussion to go along this line.
I mean, when we talk about business, let's look at companies at different stages. For example, I mean, we mentioned BioNTech, Moderna, and also in that environment, Pfizer is working. I had a look at their balance sheets in the last quarter. I mean, they have a lot of capital on the balance sheet, so they can run completely different processes. When I look back, I mean, I think BioNTech started somewhere in 2007-08. And usually when companies start or when the first scientist says, okay, that would potentially make sense to turn it into a product, this invention. Usually money is scarce at the beginning. So there are no billions in the game. At best, when you look at Austria, for example, a scientist can file for FFG grants or can go to AWS and file for pre-seed and seed. And we are talking about a few hundred thousand euros. When the scientist also has a circle of friends in which a few business angels are, we usually talk also about a few hundred thousand euros. So when I sum that up, the capital for developing a new drug product, potentially in the beginning, is about a few hundred thousand euros or up to 1 or 2 million euros. So it's a huge difference to 8 billion. What I heard from patent processes is that they are really expensive and can burn a lot of money. How is the reality initially when it comes to filing patents? How costly is this process? And how much time does it take to come to a point in which the scientists then with his business partners can go out on the market and look for further capital to develop the product further?
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question, because the patent strategy needs to meet not only the business objectives, but also the timeline. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You need a news flow, of course, but you have also then the patenting flow. At first, patents are cheap. That a first filing is always cheap. It's below 10,000. And in the life science field, you have 50 pages, 100 pages, first filings, and it's always below 10,000. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And within the priority year, you have a refiling, and usually you go for the international route, a PCT application, which is the international one. And again, it's less than 10,000. And you really have time until 30 months following the first filing. So at that time, you have the cost factor. So 30 months from your starting point, you have to decide which territory you choose for examination and granting procedures. And that will drive the costs. So in this first 30 months, you can really do a lot. Yeah, you can maybe file some more patents that you later on find, okay, I do not need it anymore. But just in case you need it, if there is a potential interest by a partner, then better have a patent application in this field. Yeah, and later on, you can be selective. So better start very brave and optimistic, filing the first patents. And then later on, when it comes to the cost drivers, you can then be selective on the territory you need and whether you need it just as a safeguard or maybe just as preventing alternatives, or whether it's really your key patent for your key product, then you go into the territorial protection worldwide. And we can discuss what means a worldwide protection maybe later on.
So when I hope I listened very closely to what you said. We are in the beginning, initially, we are at around 10,000 euros for the first application, and talk about a couple of weeks or months until the filing process is completed in a way that the people can, let's say, attack the market with marketing claims. Is that, did I get the right understanding for the, just for the start of the process?
Yeah. You can have, after your first filing, you have a priority date. And then you can go out marketing with, on an, of course, non-confidential teaser and then a confidential information package. I would be a bit careful in the first year after the first filing, because during this priority year, you can change the invention a bit, refile it when it comes to the international filing. And if you change the invention a bit, maybe you don't have the priority for it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this could be a drawback. So that's why I would better have the disclosure of the invention only under confidentiality. Yeah, during the first year. But after the first year, you can really go out and publish as you like.
No, I like the process you suggest, to first go out with a non-confidential deck that doesn't disclose any trade secrecy or any parts of the patent initially, then file a confidentiality agreement or non-disclosure agreement, then open the data room. It's also a good business practice to first find out who's really interested in doing something with that and who is just coming around to look at the technology. I mean, it doesn't make sense to use time to just show everybody what the company has. If I then interpret your words in the correct way, then after the first filing, we have 30 months until the really costly phase starts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So then it becomes really expensive. So it means the company then has two and a half years to move the technology forward on one hand, and also on the other hand, to find either industry partner, strategic industry partner, or investors who then cover the expenses after the 30 months.
Right. That's the a very practical way of moving forward. I sometimes hear I want the protection worldwide, and how do you get that? You get usually an international patent application which covers 154 countries.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a placeholder for examination and granting procedures in those countries. But it will only start after national phase entry. And this is actually 30 or 31 months after the first filing. Yeah, so then you select, let's say, US, Canada, European patent, Japan, China, and all these countries where you need translations and where you need to pay official fees. This will drive the costs.
I mean, this is a great recommendation. So basically, it's strategy first. Then once the company has the strategy or the inventors have the strategy tied down, or the initial strategy tied down, it makes sense to speak with a patent attorney. And then, let's say, roughly 30 months until this globalization phase begins. The question at the globalization, when it's also good to then involve strategic partners or investors when they come aboard in the discussion, what makes sense. Very often, 20 years ago, that 15 years ago that I started in the life science industry. I mean, when I think about the territories, I always heard back then, United States, North America is very important. Also, Europe is very important. And let's forget about the other countries. Let's forget about the other countries in the world. Now, with about 20 years later, when I look at the world, I mean, we live in a global world. Is it really helpful still? Is it really a good strategy to just say, okay, let's protect the territories in North America, the territories in Europe, and let's forget about Africa, India, and Asia?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host, Matt Heslin, brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Yeah, of course, it's a budget question. But if I think a reasonable selection is where the major markets are or the specific markets are, depending on your product, where your competitor sits or where your potential partner is located, and your home base, because you don't want that your employees maybe start a business in your neighborhood. Yeah? And from my experience, I would say a startup will pick and choose the country where potential partners are, big pharma, and also where the big pharma will seek protection because they want to sell, let's say, their assets to big pharma. So they would usually go for those countries which are also selected by big pharma. And the originator will select the major markets, but only very selectively. Yeah? When it comes to a generic company, if you want to get your generic product out, you are really choosing a very broad coverage. Yeah, every single country where generic production is maybe based. But at the end, it's all about the budget. In life science patents, there are also a few further considerations, not just only the general ones. But there's also a consideration what can be protected here and there. And there are quite some differences. Natural products, medical use claims, method of treatments, diagnostic methods, they are all handled differently in the US, in Europe, and in China. Because you were discussing China. Even 10 years ago, I heard, no, we don't need China, but this is real. That was outdated 10 years ago already. So it's every life science patentee goes for China, of course. Yeah, even more important than Japan. Korea is also on the list. Yeah, because they are very... The life science business and the production facilities in Korea, they are very good. Also, India has a life science industry that has high potential. But as I said, there are here and there some restrictions with life science topics. And the last few years, the US was quite restricted. So we are... In a paradox world where the US, USA has granted life science patent in a very strict restrictive way, and China has even developed to grant life science patent being broader with broader coverage. Yeah, so that has changed a lot, and I can maybe get you a few examples of the US. So in the 80s, we had the Chakrabarty decision, and maybe you heard about it. The Supreme Court said anything under the sun that is made by man can be patented. So that's nice. A nice story. Anything under the sun. Yeah. But that has changed in life science because there was the example of Myriad, BRCA1. The breast cancer gene mutation. Supreme Court said maybe this was the Angelina Jolie effect because she had surgery because of her prevalence of the gene mutation. Myriad could not patent the human gene, that was the gene mutation, but because this was considered as a natural product. Yeah, it was, even if it was isolated and analyzed, it was, the US Supreme Court said it is a natural product, cannot be patented. Only the cDNA, which is engineered for expression in a host system, that is artificial, that can be patented. Yeah. There's another example with diagnostic means. Diagnostic methods are just mental acts or law of nature. That was the decision of Mayo versus Prometheus. And that changed a lot. The diagnostic business in the US was really smashed because of this decision in the US. Imagine you have a diagnostic asset and in vitro diagnostic tools, and it's just measuring one parameter, and then you say, okay, if you have this pattern, you have this disease. The U.S. Supreme Court said, okay, this is just a mental act, law of nature, not patentable in the U.S. In the Europe, of course, you have, it's much better defined. You have the European guideline of biopatents, and that is very clear and says, if as long as there is a technical step, you can patent the diagnostic method, and as long as it's an isolated product, even though it's naturally occurring in blood or whatever, wherever. If it's isolated and characterized, if it's a preparation, it's patentable. So that is also needs to be taken into consideration, talking about territories. What is patentable here and there? And then you can play with the claim language and the protection that you need here and there. Maybe one more example of territorial differences in China. It's easier to have patents on products that are isolated from nature. However, diagnostics, they have different kind of claim language. That's why I told you about claim language, the appropriate one, yeah? So it's not a method of diagnosing, it's a method of producing a product for diagnosing. Yeah.
Okay.
So kind of different claim language. But you see, the USA gets more and more restrictive. And the European side is maybe on the opposite side. And the future will show which countries follow this route or that route. Canada, Australia is more and more on the US side, but the rest of the world is more on the European side.
I mean, when I look where the venture capital is going these days, I mean, yesterday I read an article in Forbes that from 1998 and 1997 that $10 billion went into venture capital, early stage venture capital, mm-hmm. And less than $1 billion, I think it was $600 million back in 1997, 1998 in drug development, in biotechs. The latest report I read from CB Insight said that globally $631 billion venture capital was invested in more or less early stage companies. And I hope I remember it right, 150 or something goes into drug development. Mm-hmm. I mean, just imagine, I mean, early stage companies, I mean, the foundation very often for a company is the patent. So if the government wants to help scientists to move forward, to explore more and more invention, whether they can be turned into products that help society, I think a less restrictive patent law would be helpful to overcome the initial hurdle. The more restrictive patent laws get, I mean, the higher the hurdle is, the less motivated I think people become. Is that the right view? Could you see it differently?
Yeah, and the example of the diagnostic products in the US is maybe a good example for that. Because if diagnostic business in the US has such a drawback because they could not protect their inventions and their investments in development of diagnostic tools, if you can't protect it because under the short-sighted argument that society needs to get access to tools for diagnosing disease, yeah, then the investments will go down in the US. Yeah. And you will have diagnostic systems outside the US because there they got the protection they need for new investments in this area. Yeah. So it has a drawback. But of course, I also understand the other side where people say, okay, this law of nature, what is the additive value of an invention in this regard? Yeah, so this was what the court was saying, and yeah, I guess it's more the Angelina Jolie effect than just the theoretical arguments.
I mean, it's a philosophical question. Maybe it's also the question, how quick can people react? I mean, just coming from the investment side, when I think, let's say, something needs 10 million investment initially to move forward. And when there is no patent process, so it's not possible to file a patent, why should an investor bet 10 million on a technology when after the initial development step, especially in diagnostics, everybody can copy it? I mean, it doesn't make sense. This investor would not be in a position to redeem her investment.
Yeah, that's the point. And of course, we also do that patenting of diagnostic systems in the US. But it's very tricky to get the right claim language and to draft the appropriate specification because there's always a way of patenting. However, the scope of protection in the US will differ from the one in Europe, where you get broad claims. And as I said, it's an international business, and you usually do not want to limit your market to only one country. Yeah, if you want to get your product out to different markets, you will need patents here and there. Or if you're seeking partners, let's say in China, a different partner than in Europe, you need patents here and there. But the scope will differ.
Mm. I mean, the other question I had, but when you brought up the patentability of different invention in different territories, I mean, I think when we talk about society or something becomes available to society, isn't the biggest problem in that's that companies file for patents that actually don't do anything with the patent. They don't develop a technology. They just have the patent filed and the market protected, but then they don't do nothing around it. Is it possible in such cases when, for example, an inventor says, okay, I mean, I have an invention. I can't protect it because company XYZ has protected the entire market for the next 20 years, so I can't find investors because I don't get the patent protection. Is there anything... let's say in development on the regulatory side that would enforce such companies to give licenses to an inventor who wants to develop actually something with a patented area within a patented area?
I think if you want to develop a product, we will find a way to patent it. Yeah. Mm. And it's not so much of the question of whether you get a patent if there was a prior one, because there's always a way of further developing an invention so that it's even better. Yeah. So it triggers improvements if there are already patents out there. But the question is whether you're dependent on it, whether you have the freedom to operate if there was a patent out there. And if somebody just has a patent application out there, it does not hinder you really, because if it's abandoned, it's just published, not granted. It's prior art, of course, for your new patent application, but it doesn't hinder you. There is still freedom to operate because it was already abandoned. Yeah. If the prior patent has already granted, the question is whether it is maintained in your territory. If people did not pay the maintenance fees, the annuities, yeah, then it's not an issue for you. Yeah, so freedom to operate very much depends on whether the prior patent was granted and whether it's maintained in the in territory of interest. And if the people are not interested in this kind in this field, usually they let the family members go abandoned by not payment the annuities, because it's getting more and more expensive the older the patents are. I think this is the patent system provided for higher annuities every year, it triggers abandoning the patents.
That makes sense. It drives people out of the market if they don't want to do anything with the patent or develop anything that redeems the cost. It doesn't make sense commercially to pay the maintenance fee. This patent area, it sounds to me that it's very complex, and sometimes it feels to me like it was rooted in...
It's easy. It's not very complex. It's really easy. It's very logical and straightforward. There are straightforward rules.
The rules, yes, but when I just think about the number of patents that are already on the market, and we have more than 8 billion people on the planet, and I think the roots of the patent system is somewhere in 1800 something, in a not connected, not globalized world with less than 1 billion people on the planet. Now we have much more scientists developing new great ideas, filing for patents. Mm-hmm. When I just think about, the rules are clear, but sometimes it might pop up that a similar technology has already been filed in China or in India, that scientists are working in the same field. How fast is this process really? When I think back to March 2020 or to February 2020, when BioNTech's founder started thinking about using their technology to produce a vaccine against a novel virus. I'm pretty sure they also had patent questions to solve. And when I then go through these articles that I read on the internet about what they had to do to turn the invention into a product that finally could be accepted by the FDA and the EMA as a new product and released to the market, I believe a few hundred millions went into the development from the concept phase until the product was on the market. When I now think about the timing, I think the founders said that they started thinking about it in February 2020 when they read about the situation in China. Mm-hmm. And less than a year later, the first product was used in real patients. And when I think about the patent process, I didn't have the feeling that alongside this fast production cycle, that the patent process is set up in a similar speed. But I now think of the effects on the pharma industry from the learnings we had through the pandemic, I believe fast product cycle or production cycles could hopefully become the norm to have quicker solutions. Is there also on the patent side something that facilitates such fast development cycles, or is it really just a risky game to say, okay, we try to bring something to the market within 1 year, we get the support from regulatory authorities, but on the patent side, it's just a game of luck or a game of chance?
Yeah, it's certainly an exceptional case, and not all the development efforts were lucky. There were many development efforts in parallel, but there was a Merck initiative, a Sanofi initiative, Sandoz, CureVac. They did not get to the successful end of the story. And there was a lot of investment. Yeah, and not really backed up by novel patenting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the virus, I think the sequence was published early 2020. And A year later, there was already a vaccine developed. Yeah, this was really an exception. And usually, you know, it takes 3 to 5 years to get a European patent granted in the life science field. And if you're lucky, be within 2 years. Yeah, even with the usual acceleration requests, and you call the examiner, you hardly get it faster. Yeah. So what do you do in such an exceptional case? In the pandemic, the regulatory review was quite adaptive. Yeah, it was, they had shortened review, they had some flexibility to get it on the market, parallel and rolling review. And did the patent system follow? Yes and no. Yeah, because in the US, there was a specific program for COVID-19 prioritized examination. Yeah, so they called Track One. And we also tried that. It was very good. We got a grant notice of allowance within 7 months after filing. And this was a prioritized examination because it was a COVID-19 topic. Yeah. Track One examination in the US was costly. It was already possible to have this kind of prioritized examination already in the past. I think it was $4,000 to get then a decision within a year. And for the COVID-19, it was for free. Yeah, so there was no additional extra examination fee for this prioritized examination. So that really was nice in the US, and it turns out to be very useful. In China, there's also a kind of similar prioritized examination. I looked at that. It was called a special program for COVID-19 related patent applications and aiming to get the allowance or rejection within 6 months, very fast. In Europe, there is no such special program, unfortunately. It's just the common PACE program. And we're really now pushing hard to get the first grant, let's say, within 18 months, hardly possible. Yeah, so in Europe, they're really not adaptive to such exceptional cases. And I also took a look at the effect of the fast-track proceedings for such COVID-19 related topics and compared Chinese, US and European grants. I found in November 2020, so less than a year, this COVID-19 related topics with first priority filings in 2020, yeah, because before it was, the gene was not known. So within a year in China, there were already 91 patents granted in this field. In the US, 15. In Europe, 0. Yeah, so this was within 1 year. So within a year later, I also took a look, it was 10 times more. Yeah, so in China, it was 999, in the US, 164, in Europe, 0. Yeah, 10 times 0 is also 0. And two months later, it was even more than 50% higher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we got to 1,500 in China, 250 in Europe, 0 in Europe. So really, it's the best strategy when it comes to such exceptional cases is to start in the US and in China first and then have prioritized examination based on a grant in the corresponding country. And this is called the patent prosecution highway that accelerates also in Europe. Yeah, so that is maybe the right strategy of filing.
China is a very interesting country when I think back to 2017 or 16, it was a trip with the Austrian Chamber of Commerce. I heard in a presentation that China plans to become the innovation leader. And what you say right now, that the sheer number of patents that were granted in a short period of time in a special topic underlines that approach in China, that they really are serious about becoming innovation
and
leader.
These are not junk patents. You know, maybe 10 years ago, people thought, they are just writing something. I looked at some selected cases. They had the vector claims, like from Oxford. Yeah. So, of course, different vectors and different technologies, but the quality of the filings are good. Yeah. So, comparable. I would say this has improved a lot.
When I look on parallel, you mentioned the patents, and yesterday I read also in the CB Insights report about the venture investments in China, in Europe, and in the United States in Q4 2021. $90 billion were invested in the United States, $50 billion in China, and it was not zero in Europe. Europe is twice as big as the United States when we look at the inhabitants, and half the size of China, roughly. And the investment in Q4 in venture capital in tech companies was $22 billion. So it's also a very small number. When I combine that now in my mind with this area that you mentioned and say, okay, $50 billion and 1,500 patents, then you have in the United States $90 billion. And how many patents were it at the end?
250.
And zero patents and $20 billion in Europe. How will the future look like?
They will pop up later. It's also a matter of speed. Of course, they were filed in Europe, but I think published there were already 340 at that time, but not granted.
But how would it then relate? I mean, what would happen if a Chinese patent is already granted in a similar area than a European patent?
You will need to work it out later. So the freedom to operate, that will be a jungle.
Okay. Yeah? Okay.
To my experience, as long as there is a market and a price, the involved parties will find a settlement because they can have a benefit. Yeah. And you can work it out later. It doesn't help to sort out any unknowns.
When I really go to early stage development and say, okay, where does the process start? It seems to me that the processes and the availability of capital is much more beneficial for early stage founders and inventors in China and in the United States than in Europe. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, when you have very quick patent processes, I think it's always good to know very early if a patent is granted or not. Would you see it similarly or other perspectives?
We have also cases which are not that exceptional, like a pandemic. and it's not always a pandemic. Yeah. So usually you have some means to accelerate in Europe and you can get a PACE request. You can call the examiner. You have the patent prosecution highway. You have preliminary protection through early publication. You have national patents. You can go the national route. You can start with a British or Swiss patent, which gives you fast protection. You can start with utility models, which gives you fast protection in selected European countries. So there are means in Europe as well.
Okay.
Yeah. But usually you have more than just a year for developing your products. Yeah. And then they can go hand in hand with the patent protection.
That's good news. Let's switch to another topic. Lately, I talked in my podcasts a lot about digitalization and how the digital world shapes all industries differently. Does it also have an effect on patent processes in general?
Yeah, I looked at the cost structure maybe the highest impact is on costs. Because as you know, that in international patenting, you need a lot of translations. You have translation costs, not just only to translate the patent applications for submissions at the local offices, but also you get the office actions in the local language. and you need to translate the office actions to report them to the applicant, to the client. And if you can have this kind of machine translations which have a very good quality nowadays, yeah, that helps a lot. It's much faster and very helpful to have translations at a lower cost. Yeah. Also, when you have a European patent granted and you want to validate it in certain European countries, there are many different languages, and you can really save a lot with using machine translations and quality-proofed machine translations. That is very helpful. So translation cost is one tool. Also, when it comes to prior art documents cited by the examiner, and we have more and more Chinese prior art held against our claims, yeah, you need to translate it to understand what was in the prior art. And again, translation by a machine translation is very convenient. Yeah. Also, video conferences is nowadays a very appropriate tool, not just between you and me or clients working on a document, in a very efficient way. It's also before the offices and court of appeals, also the board of appeal. The oral hearings at the Department of the European Patent Office, they are by video conference, so no need to travel to Munich anymore. This helps to spare costs, which is very good, and it's really working well. Home office is good and bad, and everyone will have an opinion whether it's better for you to stay at home working or not. But I think this will not help reducing the costs.
I agree. I mean, machine or AI-based translations, I'm surprised how well that really works these days. In the contract world, accurate translations already are. And it saves, I mean, not only on the cost side, but it saves also timing-wise. Just when I get a contract from China or from somewhere in the world that I don't understand or any document, just put it on Google Translate. And especially from this foreign language into English works really well to get a basic understanding of what's in it. And from what I heard from you right now is that these machine translations are already accepted officially. Is that really the right understanding that I got?
They are not really accepted officially, but you can use them as a tool. You know, we are working with a network of specialists all over the world. So now, I think in more than 150 countries, we have corresponding patent attorneys, all specialized in life science. So we have a network of life science specialist patent professionals. Yeah. And when we send applications in the English language, okay, please file in Malaysia. Yeah. They will translate it, yeah, and they can use or they can proofread a machine translation at lower costs than just doing it from scratch, yeah.
Okay.
And on the other hand, if we get an office action, let's say from Japan, they send us the office action from Japan, and there are already machine translation versions online available. Yeah, so you get that online at the USPTO or at the European register. So you get machine translation of the corresponding Chinese or Japanese office actions that you can use for reporting. You don't need to prepare translations anymore because that is already at the office, available at the office. So it's getting more and more into the direction to be kind of accepted, but at the end you will want to have a quality translation to be filed. Yeah.
But in between, I mean, all this communication is speed up and now cost
definitely.
Efficient. And
yeah, definitely.
And you only need one quality translation at the end of the process and not initially at the beginning of the process. Because I can also imagine during the patent processes, a lot of documents are read and visited, which at the end of the day don't end up in a patent application.
So in this way, I think digitalization will reduce costs. One more other cost factor, because we're talking about the future, I would like to mention is also a unitary patent that, that is upcoming this year. So will be upcoming. I really would not bet because I lost already several bets whether it's coming or not. But all the signs say by the end of the year, we will have a unitary patent, which means kind of European Union patent. Yeah, that will also save a lot of translation costs.
Can we stick with the topic a little bit? Unitary patent in the European Union means one language and it's valid in all countries.
That was the idea. It turned out to be a bit different, but that was the idea.
How is the reality?
Yeah. So you will have the prosecution like an ordinary European patent application that will be prosecuted, examined, and granted. So then you have a European patent. After the European patent has been granted, that covers 38 countries. Yeah, more than the European Union. After the European patent is granted, usually you have a time period to select where you want to pay the annuities, where you want to maintain or validate the European patent. So usually you select 5 or 10 or 15 or 38 countries where you want to validate this European patent. And usually you had to file translations here and there to get it validated. Now with a unitary patent, you can elect this unitary patent, which is valid for 25 European Union countries. Yeah, so you elect one unitary patent valid for 25 European Union countries. You still need to elect Switzerland and the UK and maybe Turkey or some other countries which are not part of the European Union. But it's very helpful to have one election of the European Union, 25, not 27, because Spain and Czech Republic did not ratify the agreements.
Okay.
Not yet. Maybe they will do in the future. The process is that within 1 month after the European patent grant, you can elect this unitary patent. You just need to pay the maintenance fees. Yeah, and just one maintenance fee for all, not in every single country, but one. And the maintenance fee is maybe at the cost of four individual countries. So if you would elect more than four, you just elect a unitary patent and you get 25 at the price of four. That's about the rule of thumb.
It's a good discount. Yeah. It makes it more cost efficient in the end, or?
Yeah, in the first 7 years, you need another one translation. So because they could not do it without translation. So you need, if you have it already in the English language, which we usually do, you still need one language in addition. You can choose maybe German or some Spanish or whatever, whatever you like. But during the first 7 years, you need one translation. That's it. You just need to pay the maintenance fee. There's one downside. Maybe there are more downsides, but one downside is there will be, and this is also maybe a new opportunity, there will be a new patent court that is responsible for litigating and invalidating European patents and European unitary patents. And this is called the Unified Patent Court, the UPC, and that will also be in existence by the end of this year. And the judges will get training now. So there are new judges, new patent court. Nobody knows how experienced they will be. And they will decide on validity and on infringement. Not just the unitary patents, but all European patents. So they will be responsible for all European patents granted in the past. And this is what many people think is a downside, because it's an inexperienced court, and they would not want to be the training case for the new judges. So that's why people nowadays already start with selecting which cases they are choosing for an opt-out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you can choose, let's say, your most important case for an opt-out, saying, I would not want to get that to the new UPC. So I would to have that be heard the old-fashioned way before the national courts, not before the one central court. Yeah. And this opt-out is possible also at any time. But if you start earlier, you can do that earlier. Because if somebody attacked your patent already at the UPC, you cannot no more opt out. You are really stuck with the UPC. And then you get it maybe invalidated in the worst case, invalidated for 25 countries mm-hmm. at once. Okay. So many people nowadays already select which of the cases you want to opt out. And you can start opting out 3 months before the UPC gets in existence. It's called the sunrise period. Very elegant. The sunrise period. So it will be very busy, the sunrise period, because people want to opt out their most important cases. But then I think it will turn out on the long term, if the judges are experienced and if you can trust in them, it will turn out to be a very useful tool.
Yeah, I also think so. I also think so that the benefits outweigh the risks at the end of the day. When we talk about simplification, some parts, I think, in terms of patents are becoming more and more complex. Looking at the investment world, 10 years ago, when I looked at or talked with investors, they were clearly focused on drug development. And other investors, like in Austria, for example, Speedinvest, were focusing more on the digital world. And there was basically nothing in between. So whenever I found a project that had parts of drug development in it and parts of artificial intelligence, for example, or any kind of technology outside drug development, usually I was in this nowhere land in between. So investors in the drug development world said it's too much from the digital space, and investors from the digital world said, okay, it's too much drug development, I don't touch it, and there was nothing in between. When I look at the investment world nowadays, like, for example, ARK Fund, Cathy Wood, who is talking about that the different areas of technology are coming together and there will be more links between these technologies, more products will evolve out of these dynamics that have parts of, when we stay in life science, drug development, medical mm-hmm. devices, diagnostics in it, artificial intelligence, and scientists all over the world start working together to create a huge melting, interdisciplinary melting pot. What does that mean for patents? I mean, when I think back 10, 15 years ago, when I started in life science, understanding inventions in drug development is a science by itself when it comes to patents. So it's very complex, complicated. It needs a lot of in-depth know-how in this area. And when I now try to think about how the world for you will be in the future, where you not only see one tech area, but people approach you with maybe 7-8 different disciplines that mm-hmm. Play into one patent. How will the world look like? How complex is it really for you and your team?
It's great fun. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we always talk about we are specialized in life science, and that's true. But how can you be a specialist in this large field? And that the field is getting broader and broader, as you said. Yeah, it's not just about recombinant products, engineered biologicals, genes, DNA, RNA, proteins, peptides, not so much about methods of cloning, cell culture, whatever. These are the classical life science type of thing, therapeutics, diagnostics, vaccines. Transgenic plants is also a special area. So the treatment methods, clinical methods, very, very good. I like this kind of patent stratification, but starting with patient stratification and personalization, you already get into the AI-assisted topic of digesting information and data and then finding out which patient is the one that should be in this clinical trial or should be treated and should get the medical treatment. So the tools are getting more and more interdisciplinary. Also with let's say, overlapping fields of organic chemistry and biologics, this I experienced that already quite some time ago. It's very much overlapping because, of course, nucleic acids are already also organic molecules which you can engineer. Yeah. So and you can have screening methods also because of organic structures. Yeah.
Also the ADC world.
Yeah. So you have ADC is one point, but also you can engineer oligonucleotides. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they have some chimerics. Yeah. So a lot of overlaps of the fields. But as with screening methods and personalized medicines, this is really an AI topic. But it's, as I said, it's a fun part of the story because I do not need to be the top specialist because I find that inventors are the best teachers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if there's an inventor and brings you his or her baby, you're saying, okay, I've got something very special. I get the best inventions on my table, you can bet. Mm-hmm. It's really fun listening what the people were inventing. And then in the discussion, it's about what can be the commercial application. And this is my part of it. I do not need to be the specialist in science, but I'm the buddy for the scientists finding out which is the best commercial application. And if we find, okay, this can be done, that can be done, this is the topic which I want to put on paper and get into a patent claim. So it would always be a matter of communication and discussion. It's the digesting what the specialist is telling me and formulating a patent. The same with let's say in the patent world, as I said, we are working with 150 so patent professionalists in the life science industry in 150 countries. Yeah, so we know a lot of specialists here and there, and there's always good exchange of information and discussion of how do you deal with this type of technology? How can we get that protected in Japan or in the US? And this is also another level of communication between specialists. Yeah? I do not need to know everything by heart, but I know how to discuss with them and to get the client what they need. I think this is how to deal with such interdisciplinary topics.
Yeah, I was just, while you were speaking, I was just thinking about digitalization. There's always this fear that a lot of jobs will be lost in the process of digitalization. But whenever I speak with people, also what you said right now, there will always be enough problems to solve that involves people. And when we streamline one part of the process, we tap into other parts that suddenly pop up, like interdisciplinary approaches, which involves then more and more specialists to discuss the problems and find proper solutions also in the patent process. Mm-hmm. And what you also said, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think patents are important when it's really clear what the product should look like at the end of the day. I mean, not the exact product, but at least an idea for commercialization. It's the initiating point, and companies should become the strategy straight first before thinking about patenting anything. Otherwise, it's just cost that that appears. Would you agree to that statement?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And talking about, maybe as a summary, the good part of my job is it's never boring, because and I can work with the top scientists and a network of highly specialized colleagues and with business guys and investors to get a deal done and to get products to where they are supposed to get. I mean, best to the market, of course, yeah. And this is, patents are a really great tool to get the business done. And I think this is what I cannot emphasize more. So I guess.
Yeah, completely agree with that. I mean, as initially said, I mean, Warren Buffett is a huge fan of moats, business moats, and patents are one of those. And starting with the process early helps at the end of the day to move the business forward and attract investors and also licensing partners. And I think it's not a question of getting one patent right. It's just a question of when is the right point in time to add new patents, to abandon old patents. So it's a process that runs alongside product development and not, I would say, only pops up at certain decision points in time. When I imagine that maybe one or the other scientist in the audience now thinks about involving patent attorneys, what's the right approach in your opinion? What would be your advice as a first step to these scientists?
The first step is, of course, thinking about what you have in your hands. And if you have a great technology at hand or an idea of developing a product which is not trivial and which has an interest or could trigger an interest in the market, then I think it's the right time of discussing with the patent attorney. A first discussion will always be confidential, of course. Yeah, you don't need to mandate or to sign something for a first discussion. It's always confidential. And a 30 minutes discussion is always for free. Yeah, so it's to get a first impression. Is this too early, or is this guy on the table, does he or she understand me? Is this the appropriate match? Is also a personal type of thing, yeah. Because it's entrusting someone, yeah. So this first discussion is always a good idea. If you're not sure, then just try, yeah. And then you can take it from there, yeah. In sailing, there is a say like, when in doubt, let it out. Yeah. Because then nothing happens, yeah. And here I would say, when in doubt, just call the patent attorney.
That's good advice. Yeah, one final question from my end. Did I miss any topic that you would like to have discussed in the podcast?
Oh, we could discuss for hours, I guess.
absolutely. If Is there an open topic that you would like to address at the end of the podcast?
We were discussing the value of patents and portfolio development and very important things for business and investors and partnering issues and whatever. But at the end, I think it's about the people. Yeah. Even if there are the topics of artificial intelligence are more and more important. But at the end, this is from my experience. Yeah. It's about the people. You can have the best inventions, the best patents. If the team, and it's always a team, yeah? Best team is a scientist plus a business guy, yeah? If the team is working well, they can make a lot. If the team does not work well, the best patents will not help. So it's also a matter of getting the right people on board and also getting the right patent attorney to help you. It's about the people, I think.
That's great advice. And I think this is true for all businesses. Business is always between people, and getting the relationships right initially helps creating success in the end of the day. If people work well together, everything is possible. And if the relationship don't work, it can be very challenging. I completely agree to that. Gerda, thank you very much for your time. I think we could also add another 2 hours. Maybe we have we revisit that patent topic later this year. I wish you and your team still, we're in January, so happy new year and a great 2020.
Thank you, Christian. You too.
Have a great day. Bye.
Bye.
Did you like the episode? Then please, please, please leave a 5-star review on Spotify and Apple, and make sure that you like, comment, and share the YouTube episode. It helps that the algorithm delivers the episode to people who also benefit from it the same way than you did. Have a great day.